for a number of years now, and very successfully. He is from LaGrangeville, New York. He's president of STOP International, which is STOP Planned Parenthood. In 1993, Jim was named by Planned Parenthood as one of the 15 most active fighters in the country against their sex education programs. So you can tell that his message is going to be worthwhile to us here today. Jim lives in LaGrangeville with his wife. He has three grown children, and he's a grandfather of a child who will be born in about 6 months. So please welcome Jim Sedlak.
Thank you. Is everybody here okay? Just checking out the electronics here. They always wire you up, and I'm always afraid there's somebody at Planned Parenthood with a button at the other end that's going to push. But that's never happened, so I think we're safe here this morning. What we'd like to do this morning is, you've heard the background as to why Planned Parenthood is bad and why sex education is not a good idea from various speakers all weekend long. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time telling you why sex education is bad. What we're going to spend some time on is what can you do about it if you have sex education in your schools. We'll talk first about public schools, and then we'll get into a bit about Catholic schools. My experience is much more extensive in public schools because we've done it a lot more there. I will also tell you that we've had a lot more success there. Catholic schools present unique problems and is very dependent on local pastors and their ability to see the light. But we will talk a bit about that and how to address it in Catholic schools, because Catholic schools, as you know, are not immune from the problem, and in fact, in some cases, have courses that are just as bad as some of the stuff in public schools. Well, what we want to do is to give you some practical advice, some things that you can do that when you leave, you can go back home and say, okay, here's how I want to go about doing that. Now, we have a couple of documents that we'll be talking about, and I'll hold them up as we go along. One of the things you should understand is we started our organization, Stop Planned Parenthood, back in 1985 to fight the local Planned Parenthood that was renovating a building to be able to do abortions. And this was prior to forming the organization. I had been a member of Right to Life for about 6 years, and this whole organization started as a reaction to abortion. It was a fight against Planned Parenthood's abortion thrust. When we first started out, we had no idea that we would get into the battle for sex education. That was not our intention. It turned out that we got into the battle, and we got into the battle because 1 year after we started, we got a phone call from a woman in New York State, because that's where we are. We're located about 70 miles north of New York City. And we got a phone call from a woman in New York State who says, we have Planned Parenthood in our schools. You have to come help us get this sex education program out of our schools. And we said, we don't do sex education, we're fighting abortion. And they said, but your name is Stop Planned Parenthood, and it's Planned Parenthood who's in our schools. So that was a problem for us, because we said, well, yeah, that is what we're trying to do, and it looks like Planned Parenthood is in the school. But we were a small organization. We had been in existence for a year, and we had collected at that time a total amount of donations of some $1,800 over the course of a year, and we looked at our budget and said, well, we can't do very much on fighting sex education, particularly in areas that are fairly far away from where we're headquartered, on $1,800 a year. And so we put together a little letter to our small mailing list. At that time, we had a mailing list of about 400 people. And we sent out a mailing to our people saying, we've been asked to get involved in the sex education battle. But if we're going to get involved in the sex education battle, we need to get more finances. And so what we would like you to do is to send us some finances, some money. And we'll judge by the amount of money you send us whether or not we should get involved in this battle, because our feeling was if we didn't have the funds to at least do some research and do some traveling, we weren't going to be able to do anything. And as I'm wont to do, as I mailed the letters, I made a deal with God. I said, if you send me $2,000 in the next month, then we'll take that as a message that we should get involved in sex education. But if we don't get $2,000 in the next month, then I'll figure you don't want us involved in that fight. Now, that wasn't much to ask, since we had taken in $1,800 in a year. You know, so $2,000 in a month, I wasn't asking much at all. So I mailed out the letters on a Monday morning to our 400 people. And on Wednesday morning, I went to the post office, and there was a letter from one of our supporters. And she wrote in a letter, and by the way, I had not mentioned this figure to anybody except God. And she wrote in a letter, and she said, "My husband died recently, and he loved children. And I know he would want you to carry on the fight, so please accept the enclosed check as my small donation to help you in your work." And it was a check for $2,000. All right, so not in a month, but in 2 days. So that's how we got involved in the sex education battle. We then went to the call the people up, who happened to be in a little town called Mount Vernon, New York, which if you know New York at all, it borders New York City. It is a highly minority town, 70% minority. And that was the town that was asking for help. And so we called them up and said, "Well, it looks like we're going to be able to do something. Let's figure out what we can do." And they said, "Well, what we need you to do is to go to meetings with us, with the school superintendent and with the head of the family life education curriculum in the school, and to discuss what's wrong with it." And I said, "Well, this sounds like it's going to be meetings during the day." And she said, "Well, yeah, it takes place during the day." I said, "Well, you're 50 miles from where I work, and although I might be able to take off a day here or there, I'm not going to be able to attend too many meetings, but we'll see what we can work out." And I worked at that time for IBM in East Fishkill, New York, which is about 50 miles from Mount Vernon. The next week, my boss calls me in and says, "Jim, we have a temporary assignment for you. We want you to work for the next 2 years in Harrison, New York." Well, Harrison, New York is about 5 minutes from Mount Vernon. And so I wound up working down in Harrison and being able to attend meetings during lunch breaks and lunch times and all kinds of arrangements that we could make at that particular job. And so that's how we got involved heavily in the sex education battle. Now, the other interesting fact about the Mount Vernon battle is that, as I found out later, not knowing anything from the beginning, as I found out later, the Mount Vernon sex education program was the model sex education program for Planned Parenthood for the country. It had been put in place in Mount Vernon after they had done some experimenting earlier. It had been put in place in Mount Vernon in 1979, the original year. It was totally paid for by Planned Parenthood. They provided all the text for the course. They provided all the materials. They trained all the teachers. And in subsequent years, although the school district started picking up the costs for the books and pamphlets, et cetera, Planned Parenthood still was training the teachers each year. They was all headed up by Planned Parenthood of Westchester, Rockland. That was the group that was heading up the sex ed program in Mount Vernon. And then as I picked up New York State guidelines, they always referred to the Mount Vernon sex education program. So we not only got involved in sex ed fight, but we got involved in the fight against the Planned Parenthood program of the time. Okay. And this was in 1986, that a program had been in the school for 7 years. So we learned a lot, and a lot of what I'm going to share with you today has to do with the Mount Vernon program and others that we were fighting. But not knowing a lot about sex education, we went looking for information. And God, in his goodness, provided us three documents. And those three documents carried us through the fight. They allowed us to have the knowledge and the information to really take on the enemy. And by the way, I will tell you that if you've sat through the last day and a half here, you know more than most of the people on the other side. In fact, you know more probably than any of them, except the real high officials. Most of the people on the other side have never been exposed to the kind of information that you've gotten here at this conference over the last couple of days. So never be hesitant about going in and challenging them or fighting against them, because you have the facts on your side. And then we're going to discuss in a second how you can make sure that those facts come out. But there are three documents that you ought to have. One is a document called the Humanist Manifestos. Now, let me just ask by a show of hands, how many of you are familiar with the Humanist Manifestos? Okay, quite a few. That's great. This is the document of the other side. If you want to know what's going on, what their ideas are, what their philosophies are, this tells you. Particularly Humanist Manifesto 2. Now, Humanist Manifesto 1 was written in 1933, signed by some 34 people, including a gentleman named John Dewey. You may recognize him as being instrumental in the educational systems of this country. Humanist Manifesto 2 was written in 1973, signed by 116 people, including a gentleman named Alan Guttmacher. Alan Guttmacher, at the time, was president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Many, many officials of Planned Parenthood, of CECUS, and of other affiliated organizations have won an award known as the Humanist of the Year Award. This is the award that is given out by the American Humanist Society to the people who do the most in spreading this kind of doctrine. You will find this kind of doctrine in all of the sex education programs that are being pushed into schools. You will find it in other places. Now, I want to state right at the beginning that sex education is not the only thing that's wrong in the schools. There's lots of things going on in the schools that are objectionable. But sex education was the entry point. It was the entry level. It's the one that they get in first. Even if you take a look at a lot of the Goals 2000 kinds of programs that are coming down, it always, in many cases, their first entry has to do with teenage pregnancy and teenage sexuality. This is their entry point. This is what they try to get in on, and then they spread out from there. And the same thing with the sex education programs. If you heard Charlie Donovan's talk on Friday night on the history of sex education programs, he pointed out the first sex education book written was by Margaret Sanger in 1912. And Margaret Sanger, of course, was the founder of Planned Parenthood. And they have a history of being involved in this. Understanding the Humanist Manifesto will let you really understand who these folks are. Now, since most of you have read it or are familiar with it, I'm not going to spend much time on it because that's not the purpose of this talk. I will tell you that we do have copies on the table right outside the door. You're welcome to pick up copies as you go out. But there's two important areas that I think we just ought to all know is in here, even those who haven't read it. One is on moral values. And the humanists write the following. The humanists say, we affirm that moral values derive their source from human experience. Ethics is autonomous and situational, needing no theological or ideological sanction. There is no right or wrong, is what they say. And that's what is put across in all of these programs to the kids. The kids are told, you decide what's right and what's wrong. When this first came out in 1973, it was known as situation ethics. In today's classrooms, it's values clarification or critical thinking is the latest title that they're putting on it. It's all you decide, right or wrong. And the programs are filled with it. The other section is specifically mentioned in the Humanist Manifesto in 1973 is the following. They say, in the area of sexuality, we believe that intolerant attitudes, often cultivated by orthodox religions and puritanical cultures, unduly repress sexual conduct. A civilized society should be a tolerant one. Where have you heard that word before? Right. Short of harming others or compelling them to do likewise, individuals should be permitted to express their sexual proclivities and pursue their lifestyles as they desire. And so, of course, you get into the acceptance of all kinds of sexual activity and actually the pushing of all kinds of sexual activity. So understanding the Humanist Manifesto gets you a real understanding of where these folks are coming from an ideological base. Because a lot of the stuff that you read in your sex education programs, the first question that will come to your mind is, where did they get this stuff from? Okay? This is crazy. And then you go read this and you find out where they got it from. So I give you this as the first document. The second document is a little article that is very, very powerful. It's called A Psychoanalytic Look at Today's Sex Education. Again, we have this out on the table outside. It's by Dr. Melvin Anschel. This article, as short as it is, will tell you all the reasons you need why classroom sex education can never be a good thing. It doesn't work, and it's predictable that it doesn't work. Dr. Anschel goes through in this short article the stages of human sexual development and talks about the first stage from birth through the 5 years of age, and talks particularly about 3 to 5 year olds who are the normal development is characterized by an interest in their bodies and body parts, and points out that today's sex education programs that force kids to dwell on that, to identify body parts, the kind of program like Planned Parenthood pushes in Vermont, where in first grade a boy and a girl stand facing each other in class. Now they are fully clothed and there's no touching, but the boy and the girl stand facing each other in class, and each must name all the parts of the other's body, including the genitals and the buttocks. First grade. By third grade in that same program, the teacher is passing out cellophane bags, ping pong balls, straws, and a few other things, and the kids are making models of the human genitals in third grade. It's forcing them to dwell in this early stage of sexual development. Anschel then goes on to discuss the sexual latency period, 6 through 12. It's a time in children's lives when they will normally be uninterested in sex. And any of you who have raised children undisturbed by these sex education programs know that 7, 8, 9-year-old children are not interested in sex. It's the time that they are most able to be educated in their lives. You can teach them science, math, literature, languages. You can teach them all kinds of things because their sexual interest is repressed and all of this other stuff is out there. They are curious. They are interested. They want to know why airplanes fly, why the sky is blue. They don't want to know how to make babies. It's not a natural interest to them. And Anschel points out that when you force the kids to dwell on sex by introducing classroom sex education programs at that point, you disturb their entire development. And the critical point is even if you're giving them good sex information, you're disturbing their development. Because they shouldn't be dwelling on sex at that time in their life. That should not be their point of interest. Classroom sex education is harmful regardless of its content in the general ages of 6 to 12. Now, once you get beyond 12 years old, you have the reemergence of sexual interest. And as Anschel points out, now the kids are interested in sex, but there's a little problem for the sex educators, and that is boys and girls are different. When the sexual interest reemerges in the boys, their interest is physical. Boys look for physical sex. That's their normal, natural kind of evolving. Their interest is physical. Girls who have not been disturbed by sexual education programs are not interested in physical sex. They are interested in love and in romance. A normal 13 or 14-year-old girl who has not been previously exposed to sex education programs is not interested in having a physical relationship. She is interested in romance. You can't teach romance in a classroom. The only thing you can teach is the physical aspects. And so they develop these sex education programs that teach the physical aspects. And what these programs do very predictably is they further enforce the boys' drive for physical sex. Because they already have this desire, and now they go to class, and that's all they're talking about is physical sex and condoms and all these various devices that you should be using. And they reinforce the boys' drive for physical sexual activity. What they do with the girls is the girls are sitting there saying, but I'm not interested in that. There must be something wrong with me. And they start to break down the natural barriers that the girls have to physical sex. Because that's all they hear about. And the predictable result, once you reinforce the boys' physical drive and you start breaking down the girls' reluctance, is more sexual activity. Especially when you tell them in the classroom, as all these programs do, don't worry about getting pregnant because we can give you all these devices that will stop that from happening. And so you take away some of the fear, you take away some of the mystery. Children will typically not engage in activities that they are not sure of. They don't like to go into new situations. So if they are not sure what sex is, then they stay away from it. But once you tell them what it is and describe it for them and give them all this detail, they're not afraid of it anymore. Oh, I know what that is. And they have no reluctance to get involved in it. And so the result is you have more sex. Dr. Anchell's article in this little few pages really gives you all you need to know as to why these programs are bad. The third item that God put in our path in 1986, I don't have in front of me because I know you have it all at home. It happens to be a book called The Bible. It's interesting on how much that gets involved in this. And I encourage you to read Matthew chapter 10. And if you read Matthew chapter 10, you'll know more than anything I'm going to tell you here today how to fight sex education programs in your schools. And we'll cover that. But Matthew chapter 10 is the third document that God led us to in the summer of 1986. So he gave us the Humanist Manifesto, he gave us Anchell's article, and he gave us Matthew 10. And if you have those three, you can fight sex education programs anywhere and be successful. We have to define what successful is, and we will. But you can fight. Now, one of the key things, of course, which you may have guessed from my last reference, is you can't fight sex education programs without God. You can't hope to go in and argue from a secular perspective and hope to win the battle against sex education. This is a religious fight. These people, by the way, if you read Humanist Manifesto 1, describe this as the religion of humanism. You're fighting against their religion, which is the religion of the devil. And you've got to fight it with God. And so the whole approach to this is with God. Now, we have been involved in about 36 school districts in extensive fights, much more than that in fights where we were just advising to people. I do a lot of phone call advising where people call me up and say, well, this is what's going on. What should we try? And then they try it, and then they come back, and then we make further suggestions. And I'm always available to do that. But in about 36 school districts, we were actually physically involved in attended meetings, attended sessions, etc. And people kept asking us for something that they could follow, something that would tell them how to fight. And so we put together this little book called Parent Power, which discusses how to fight sex education programs in public schools specifically. Because this is what this was based on. It was based on 7 different school districts that we chose to highlight. And we wind up with a checklist on pages 84 and 85 on 40-point checklist on how to fight these programs in the schools. If we're going to have truth in advertising, I guess I really have to tell you there's only 39. Because item 1 and item 40 are the same item. And both say, rely on God. Okay? So there are 39 items. But what we want to do this morning is we'll cover some of those 39 items. But let me just tell you that I mentioned to you before the Humanist Manifesto, the psychoanalytic look, they're all on the table out there. So is Parent Power. And what we're doing this morning, because we'd like to get this in everybody's hands, is normally we ask $5 for this and $2 for the Humanist Manifesto and one. You can have all three for $5 if it'll be of help to you. All right, it'll just about cover our cost for producing everything. And we'd like to get it into as many hands as possible. So that's my little... Father Matthew keeps telling me, you got to sell the books. All right, and I said, well, now, but if you want it, it's there. It's helpful to you. We'd love to get it in your hands. But this is the information to get out there and to fight against these programs. Now, the first thing you have to do if you're fighting against the programs is find out what's going on in your school. It's not enough to come back from a conference like this where you learned all about what's happening in schools all across the country and go in and fight, because you don't know what you're fighting. You don't know what's in your school. So find out what's going on in your school. We tell people who have not been involved in this very much, take 2 to 3 months to find out what's going on in your school. And that's 2 to 3 months of hard work. Now, how do you find out? Well, the first thing you do would be to go into the school and ask to see the health curriculum for the 5th grade, the 7th grade, and the 11th grade. Those are the 3 grade levels that this stuff usually slips in first. It's not the only grade levels they will be, but if they're anywhere, they're going to be there. The 5th grade, because traditionally in schools, that's where they have the puberty lessons for boys and girls. And so they slip into the 5th grade program. The 7th grade, because that's when the kids are getting into their teens, and most of them are coming out of puberty. And so they get some very offensive programs there. And the 11th grade, because that's usually their last shot at getting the kids. It's no sense teaching them anything in 12th grade because they're not going to learn that anyway. They just want to get graduated. But in the 11th grade level, they usually have a fairly strong program there. So you look at those 3 grade levels, the 5th grade, the 7th grade, the 11th grade. You look for 3 topics, abortion, homosexuality, and masturbation. And you see how your program in your school treats those 3 topics in those 3 grades. You'll get a real good idea of what's going on in your school, as to whether it's good stuff or bad stuff or whether there's any harmful stuff in there. Now, I will tell you that Planned Parenthood is trying to get into your school. They announced in 1986 a corporate goal of mandatory K-12 sex education in every school district in the nation. At the time they announced that, there was only one state, the state of New Jersey, that had mandatory sex education. Today there are 17 states that have mandatory sex education. Now, some of those, like the state of Utah, is not a problem because they have mandatory sex education, but they say it must be abstinence and you cannot teach pregnancy prevention. Okay? Planned Parenthood is real upset with the state of Utah. And some of these programs that they have in the various states are some guidelines from the state that says you should, every school district must teach sex education, but doesn't spell it out, which means it's really up to your local school board and even many of the states that have mandatory. But only 17 have mandatory sex education. You should find out what your state laws are. Because when you start to fight this stuff, what you're going to find out is the people in the schools are going to lie to you. And that's one of the things that you have to wrestle with in this fight, because it's not something that you expect. But they will absolutely lie to you. They'll lie to you. They'll say anything they can to get you to back off. One of the things we had a school district where we had 9 parents, 18 people, but 9 sets of parents. 9 families, if you will, who were upset about this program, sex education program in a school. And what we did in that particular school district after we had identified everything is we sent each of the 9 parents in on a different night to talk to the school principal about the problem. And so on 9 nights in a row, 5 1 week, 4 the next week, this school principal was confronted with a set of parents who were upset about the sex education programs. And I will tell you that each of the parents, including the last couple to go in, were told they were the only ones who had ever complained about the program. Okay? And we knew there were at least 8 more because we had sent them in. But that's what they were told, because that would keep them quiet. Nobody else objects to this program. Right? You're the only ones who have ever raised this objection. Now, in New York State, as liberal as New York State is, we do not have mandatory sex education in New York State. You do not have to teach sex education in any school district in New York State unless the Board of Education of that particular school district adopts it as a policy. Now, we had a parent in one school district in New York State who called, who received a letter home from the school that says your child will be involved in this sex education program in the school for the next 2 weeks. And the parent called the principal and said, I don't want my child involved. And she said she was told by the principal, you have no choice, this is a state mandate. And she said, I didn't think it was mandated. And they went back and forth in discussions. And so the mother called the state education department in our state capital of Albany. And she talked to a lawyer at the state education department and said, is sex education mandated? And the lawyer said, no, it is not. And she said, well, my principal seems to be under a misconception. Would you call my principal and tell her that this is not mandated? And the lawyer said, sure, be happy to. So they got off the phone, and the mother waited a couple hours, and she called back to the state education department. She talked to the lawyer and said, did you call my principal? He said, yep. And did you tell her it wasn't mandatory? He said, yep. And what did she say? She said, I knew that. Okay. So the mother then, the next day, happens to already have scheduled a meeting on this issue with the school superintendent, the principal, and the mother on this letter that was sent home. And they go in and they sit down at the meeting. And the mother says, I want to know why we're having this sex education program in the school. And the school principal says, because it's mandated by the state. Now, this mother did what I recommend all of you to do in this fight. She kept a lock. Every time she talked to somebody, she noted it down in a little notebook. Tuesday, October 25th, 9 a.m., I talked to Jane Doe, and here's what we said, and here's what transpired. And she kept the lock. And so when the principal said that, she said, wait a minute. She took out her lock. She says, at 9 o'clock yesterday morning, I called the state education department, and then I talked to so-and-so and so-and-so, and then I, you know, related the whole story. And she got all finished, and the school superintendent, who was rather shocked, looked at the principal and said, is all that true? And the principal said, yep. And he says, is sex education mandated? She said, no. And she was forced to write a letter to the parents explaining that the parents had the option of having the kids in or not having the kids in. But they lied to you. Be prepared for the lies. It happens, so you have to know what you're talking about. So take your time in the beginning to get in and look at these health curriculum. Now, the other place you want to go in the schools is the teacher's reference section of the school library. Your school library has two sections, one for students and one with reference books for teachers to use to prepare their classes. And go into the teacher's reference section and look for the books on human sexuality and read through them and see what they have to say. We usually find some of our most offensive material in the teacher's reference section of the library. And if you find some things that are particularly offensive, make a copy of them. There's usually a copier somewhere around the library or the office. You make a copy of a page or two out of the book, so you have a sample of what it is that's in there. Then you know what's going on in the schools. And later on, by the way, somebody's going to say, well, that's not for the kids, that's for the teachers. And you say, well, if that's not supposed to be taught to the kids, why is it for the teachers? The other thing is, if you find something particularly offensive, it's often good at some point later on when you're talking before the school board to read it to them. They will all frequently stop you in the middle and say, you can't discuss that in public. You say, well, now, wait a minute, let's talk about that, because this is what you're teaching our kids. Okay? But look in the teacher's reference section of the school library. Get copies of the curriculum. Now, some school districts, when you go in and you ask for a copy of the health curriculum, will give you a copy of the health curriculum. Some of them will even tell you, well, we don't have one. All right? You say, you don't have one? All right? I'm paying all of this money in taxes for you to run a school, and you don't even have a curriculum written out? All right? And if you challenge them enough, well, yeah, we do have one, but, you know, it's not in its final form yet. We're still working on it. You know, they work on it for years. Insist It's your right to have a copy of the curriculum. Now, it's your right regardless of whether or not you have a child in that school. As long as you live in the district and you're paying tax money for this school, it's your right to know what your tax money is being used for. You don't have to have a child in the school to get involved. And in fact, in some cases, it's more beneficial to have somebody who does not have a child in the school. It's where grandparents come in very, very handy, because they don't have to worry about retaliation. It's where single people in the community come in very handy. They don't have to worry that there might be some retaliation taken out on their child, because they don't have a child in that school. It's where people who have children in the local Catholic school that happens to be good can still fight against what's going on in a public school, because your tax money is still paying for it. People who are homeschooling should still be fighting against what's going on in the public school, because your money is paying for it. And you have this advantage of them not being able to retaliate in any way. Now, the retaliation thing, let me just tell you, our experience has been that there has been some, in some school districts, some retaliation against the kids, but it is not the normal thing. It does happen. We know of cases where it's happened. We've experienced it. We've been involved in it. But in most of the school districts that we've been involved in, there has not been retaliation against the kids. So the retaliation issue is a real that you should worry about and just monitor, but it's not something that's going to happen in every case. And in fact, our experience is in most cases it doesn't happen. Right, they'll fight you, and they'll try to discredit you, but they'll separate you from the kids. They may tell you your kids what crazy parents they have, but they know that already. So, you know, that's nothing new to them. So you want to go in and you want to find out all the stuff that's going on. You want to get all the details of what's going on, and then you want to identify what's wrong. Now, it's very important for you to write down what is wrong with what's going on in your school. Specifics. You have a specific film that is being shown to fifth graders that you object to. Write it down. Name it a film. Why you object to it. You have specific promotion of homosexuality in grade six, or, you know, whatever the issue is. Make sure you identify it, and then make sure you write down what you want the school to do about it. Now, in most cases, that's very simple. All sex education out of the classroom, okay? And they say, you're crazy. Say, yeah, but that's what we want, okay? That's what I would always ask for. But write down specific. Now, the reason I say write all this down is because once you get into the battle, people are going to distort what you object to, and people are going to distort what you want. And if you have it written down, you can, you know, when the reporter comes up and they say, well, you object, they say you object to this, that, whatever, say, no, here is specifically what we object to. We have written it down. We have given it to the school board. Here it is. And here is what we want. We have written it down. Take the time to do that. First of all, it helps you formulate your own thoughts. It helps you concentrate on the issue. One of the important things is don't try to fight too many issues at the same time. There are all kinds of things wrong in your school. There are sex education courses wrong in your school. You may have death and dying courses where kids are laying in caskets at funeral homes. We have those kinds of things going on. You have outcome-based education programs, which may be bad in many cases. You have all kinds of stuff going on in a school that you object to. Don't try to fight them all at once. You're not going to win fighting them all at once. Take one. Our view is the sex education one, because that's the one that's most harmful and the worst. And fight that. And I tell you, when you fight that, you'll be affecting the others, because they'll start to become very sensitive to, well, we don't want to go too far in these other programs, or these people might get involved in that, especially if you win the sex education battle. Then they become very, very sensitive for years about what they do. All right, they'll come back and try later on. But fight one battle at a time. If you're fighting the sex education battle, stay focused on the sex education battle. Yes, we understand there's other stuff that's bad in the school, but that stuff was there before, and when you get done fighting sex ed, it'll be there for you to fight. All right, but one at a time. So focus on the fight. You know, knowing what the laws are in your state will be very helpful. For example, in New York State, there is mandatory AIDS education. We do have a state mandate in New York to teach AIDS education. And the other side uses this to get sex education in. But if you read the New York State mandate on AIDS education, it says a child must be taught once in elementary school, once in junior high, and once in senior high what AIDS is, how it's transmitted, and how to prevent transmission. And that's it. You can do that in a half an hour, three times during a 13-year school career, and you've satisfied the AIDS mandate. Of course, many school districts turn that into a three-week program for every grade level. Right, but know what your mandates are in your state. Know specifically what is mandated, because then everything else is up to the school board to either approve or not approve ultimately. It'll be your school superintendent or the school principals who will be the first level, but then up to the school board. Once you've identified the problem and you have all of this stuff written down, you know what you want, you know your objective, now you're ready to go ahead with the fight. Before you read the material, by the way, when you get all of this pamphlet and books and stuff from the school and you sit down to try to figure out what's wrong with it, before you read the material, pray. Pray to the Holy Spirit and ask Him to enlighten you and to make the objectionable things pop off the pages for you. Because a lot of this stuff is camouflaged in nice language and that you can gloss over if you're just reading. You need some help in reading this. And God will provide the help. And so ask the Holy Spirit to give you that enlightenment to see what's on those pages. And it'll pop off to you and you'll know what it is. And trust your instincts. As somebody said earlier in one of the talks, what's your credentials? The answer is, I'm a parent. Trust your instincts. If you read something and it sounds like garbage, it probably is. Don't be afraid to jump on something like that, especially if you've prayed ahead of time because it's God telling you that's garbage. Right? Trust it. You know better. You're raising your kids. You have the graces to do that and to spot these kinds of things. Don't even question whether or not what you think is garbage is really garbage, because probably is, most likely. So just go with it. So do all of this kind of stuff. Now, when you're ready to go into the fight, now is the time you pull out Matthew chapter 10. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with Matthew 10, it is that part in Matthew's gospel where Christ tells his apostles how to spread his word, how to spread God's message. And in order to fight Planned Parenthood sex education programs or CECUS sex education programs or any of these programs, what you need is to spread God's word. Those of you who saw the film last night that they showed on the saving our children from the sexual revolution know that was the whole message. Prayer. Spread God's word. As even Ted Koppel, I was amazed, Ted Koppel on this program said they weren't 10 commandments. I mean, they weren't 10 suggestions, they were 10 commandments. Okay? You've got to be able to go out and enunciate the truth and be able to say, unlike these folks, be able to say there is a right and a wrong, and we insist on our kids learning right and wrong. Now, when you go to the school system, the first thing, well, maybe not the first thing, but one of the first things you're going to hear is you can't impose your values on the rest of the community. You can't ask the school to teach your religion. And your answer to them should be, I'm not asking the school to teach my religion. I can do a very good job of teaching religion to my children. But I am demanding that the school stop teaching things that are against my religion. If my religion says abortion is wrong, you have no right to teach my children that abortion is okay. If my religion says that homosexuality is wrong, you have no right to teach my children that this is the argument that was used successfully in New York City, that bastion of conservatism. This is what the parents said to the New York City School Board when they tried to put in a program called the Rainbow Curriculum. that taught homosexuality to first graders. And it worked so successfully that not only did the program get thrown out of the school, but the school's chancellor got fired from his job. Because the parents said, just what I told you. That was their battle cry. And even the liberals of New York City could understand that battle cry. Right? The battle cry that says, you have no right to teach my children things that are against my religion. That's the answer when they tell you that. And they'll say, well, geez, there's so many different religions in this town and so many different beliefs. If we had to do that, we couldn't teach sex education at all. Yay! Right? You got the message. And then, of course, they'll say, but if we do away with sex education, it's going to create a vacuum. And nature abhors the vacuum, and we have to do something to fill up the vacuum. You say, well, how about more math courses, more science courses, more English courses? You know, all these things that you're supposed to be teaching. Why don't we do that? Do you know that about 20% of high school graduates cannot read their diplomas? I mean, that's the kind of school system we have. So why not fill the day with those kinds of things? We point out to the administrators that we have never, ever met a teacher who said she didn't have enough to teach to fill up the day. We have lots that we can teach these kids. Sex education is not one of them. So you be prepared for that argument, because you're going to get that argument. When you go in and you fight and you're arguing on this issue, don't be afraid to bring up national statistics. Don't be afraid to bring up things like the Atlantic Monthly article. You know, that happens to be the most recent, so we say that. There are previous articles published in the Wall Street Journal, research by Stan Weed and others, that demonstrate that these programs are utter failures. Bring all of that stuff up. Make sure that they understand all of that kind of stuff. But you have to fight on what's going on in your local school. So, but you've taken the time now and you have the research to do that. If there's a confrontation where they say, go have a meeting, you know, well, we're going to have a meeting between you and the advocates for the other side, don't be afraid to do that. It will be a revelation to you how little they know and how much you know. In Mount Vernon, one of the first things they did is they had a meeting with the school superintendent, the head of the Family Life Education Program, and the parents and myself. And so we went into this meeting, and on our side of the table was myself and three other parents. And on the other side of the table was the school superintendent, the head of the Family Life Education Program, a Family Life Education teacher, a gym teacher, and a Catholic Monsignor on the other side of the table. And we were just about to get started with the meeting, and the Catholic Monsignor stands up and says, I don't have time to stay for the whole meeting, but I just want to let you know that I totally support the Family Life Education Program in the Mount Vernon schools. I think it is a wonderful program. I support these fine women who are leading the program, and this program has my total support, and I just wanted to let everybody know that. Thank you. I have to go to a meeting now. And he left. So we went on with the meeting, of course, and we said, well, here's the problems that we have with the program. And we said, their program pushes contraceptive use. And the school superintendent says it does not. Right? And so we read several items from the program. And the school superintendent looked at the Family Life Education Coordinator and says, is that in our program? And she said, no. Right? And we read a few more things, and she denied that was in their program. And he said, where are you getting this stuff from? So we handed him his program. All right? And he read it. And then he said, then we made the statement about these programs not working. And the Family Life Education Coordinator said, that's not true. We know that these things work because we have a lot of experience, especially in St. Paul, where there's a clinic program and has been shown to reduce the fertility rates amongst the kids. And we said, well, see, at that point we didn't know too much about sex education, but God had let us read this program in St. Paul. And we said, well, do you know that fertility rate means birth rate, not pregnancy rate? And those programs lowered the birth rate by increasing the number of abortions. for the kids. And so they didn't work to reduce teen pregnancy. That was the last thing she said for the whole meeting, because that's all she knew. She just had these statements that she had, these studies that she had, and when you could challenge the studies, then they keep quiet. And then the truth starts coming through. And the truth started coming through in that meeting. And we had several meetings with the Mount Vernon School Board. Mount Vernon, by the way, not only had a sex education program, they had a school-based clinic in the schools. It was being installed the year that we were starting this fight. They were preparing to install it. One of the things that Matthew 10 tells you is that what you've heard in secret, shout from the rooftops. What Matthew 10 tells you is when you learn like you learned this weekend of all of the bad stuff, you can't be quiet about it. You have to go out and challenge. And when you go to these meetings with these superintendent of schools, with these leaders of the Family Life Education Committee, one of the things you learn very quickly is that there is another very apt verse in Matthew 10. And he tells you when you're called before tribunals, and certainly in today's world, most of the meetings with school officials and school boards are could be classified as tribunals. But when you're called before tribunals, don't worry about what you're going to say, because it will not be you who's speaking, but the Spirit of the Lord speaking through you. And you have to believe that. And you have to, every time you go into a meeting, every time you go into a discussion, you have to give it to God. And let God direct the conversation. Believe me, I did not know that I was going to talk about the St. Paul program that morning. And if you had asked me about it probably about an hour before, I would have said, what was the St. Paul program? But at the time she mentioned it, God put that in my mind. I had read it before, and he recalled it. You've absorbed a lot of things this weekend, things that you don't even remember at this point. But if you need it, God will put it in your mind, and you will say it. Now, there's a trick to doing this, and the trick to doing this is when you have these meetings, when you talk to the school superintendent, when you talk to the school boards, etc., and you've given this to God, after you're finished and you walk away from the meeting or you walk away from a presentation that you've given, you can't say, oh, I wish I hadn't said that. Oh, why did I say that like that? Oh, I forgot to say. You can't say any of that. Because if you give this fight to God, you say what he wants you to say, and you don't say what he doesn't want you to say. And what he wants you to say it, it'll be said. And he'll see to it that things happen. We had in the Mount Vernon fight, we had a night, the gal who was heading it called me up, and she said, I have a school board meeting tonight, and we're discussing the school-based clinic stuff, and what I need is a lawyer to talk to the school board about all the legal ramifications of having a school-based clinic at the schools. And I said, you know, you're right, but, you know, the meeting's in an hour, and we don't have time to get you a lawyer tonight, but we'll get you one for next month. And she said, that's fine. I just want to let you know that's what we need. So she went off to her meeting, and I went about doing the work, and about 3 hours later, she called me back, and she said, Jim, you'll never guess what happened tonight. She said, we were sitting at the meeting discussing school-based clinics, and all of a sudden, this guy I've never seen before stands up. He identifies himself as a lawyer, and he starts talking about all the legal ramifications of having a school-based clinic on site. And she said, after the meeting, I went up to him and said, gee, that was a great presentation. Who are you? And he said, oh, I'm a lawyer. I just moved to town yesterday. He said, I moved into a house, and he gave her the address of the house. It was three houses away from her. He said, and in the place where I used to be, we were fighting a school-based clinic, and I heard that there was a school board meeting tonight, so I thought I'd come over just to see what was going on. And he said, when they started discussing it, I knew what I had to say. And the end of the story was he's only lived in that town for 1 year and then moved on to another town. But the night that woman needed him there, he was there. And that, of course, was due to our great planning. No, that's because you give this fight to God. God takes care of things like that. Right? He will see to it that things happen. And it's important that you know that you give this fight to God. It's important that you don't question what you say. If you give it to God before you go into a meeting, don't worry about what you say at the meeting. you'll say what he wants you to say. And you won't say what he doesn't want you to say. Maybe in another meeting he'll have you say that other stuff. So you have to give this fight to God. In Matthew chapter 10, there are a lot of good information about how to go about this fight. But one of the things you learn in this fight very quickly is that you will win with God, but you will win in his time, not in your time. We are very impatient people. We say, God, we want you to do away with abortion now. God, we want you to get rid of sex education now. He doesn't work that way. I don't know why he doesn't work that way. He doesn't work that way. I tell people one of my favorite signs in a Christian bookstore is, God, give me patience and hurry. Okay? Because we want things done now. Now, I will tell you of a school district, in fact, we discussed it in a book, where the people fought and lost every time they went to the school board. They lost every vote that ever took place. And when the whole thing was over and they looked back about 2 years later, they suddenly found out that they had so sensitized the community that they had actually won everything. It was a program where they were challenging the establishment of a program for abused children in the classroom for a psychiatrist to come in. It was a Planned Parenthood psychiatrist who was going to come in and do some counseling with the kids. And the program, they lost on fighting the program. The program got authorized, got initiated, and then that particular counselor moved out of town, and the school board said it's not worth the trouble to try to fight this all over again, so they never bothered to fight it again. And they never bothered to reauthorize the program. So even though the folks had lost the vote, they wound up winning the fight. And you'll find that this happens frequently, that God has his plans for motivating and extending the community. It happens not only in school board fights, it happens in other fights that we see with Planned Parenthood, but it happens in school district fights in a lot of cases. Now, when you have all of your information, And you've read Matthew chapter 10, and you're not afraid to go out and speak, and you know that God's going to be with you, the first thing you do is go to your teacher who is teaching the program, and you let your objections be known. Chances are you're not going to get anywhere. But if you go to the school principal first, they're going to say, well, did you talk to the teacher? All right, so there's a chain of command that you have to go through. Now, this can be one day right after another. You don't have to give these people 7 months to respond. But you go to the teacher. If you get no results there, you go to the school principal. If you get no results there, you go to the school superintendent. And then if you get no results, you go to the school board. And the school board is the group that has the ultimate authority to make this kind of a decision on what is being taught in the schools. Now, I will tell you, they don't want to make the decision. They will tell you, well, that's what we hire the school superintendent for, or that's why we have principals. And you say, yes, but that's what we elect you for. Or that's why you're appointed, if you happen to be in an appointed district. One of the amazing things in New York City was that they have an appointed central school board, and they still won the fight. So you can win the fight even if you're in an appointed district. But in most places in the United States, you have elected school board members. Now, they think they would rather deal with budgets and finances and whether or not to build a new building or how many new school buses to buy. That's the thing they're used to dealing with. They are not used to dealing with course curriculum. But that's not to say that you can't hold them responsible for that and can't insist that they get involved. Now, there's a pattern that we've seen time after time that's going to happen when you go to the school board. School boards work on a school year basis, September to June. They believe that during that time period, they're going to have problems that come up. Happens every year. Problems that come up. They also believe if they can put the problem off to June, it'll go away. And so the first year that you go before the school board and you bring up this issue, expect to be delayed until June. Expect, well, we'll discuss that at the next meeting. Well, we'll form a committee to look at that. Oh, we'll have that reviewed and get a report back. Whatever they can do to delay this thing until June, that's what they're going to try to do. They expect you to go away. Next September, when you come back and you're still talking about the same issue, they start to take you a little more seriously because you were supposed to go away. And so the second year, they either do one of two things. They try to utterly discourage you, or they try to give you just a little bit to pacify you and hope that'll make you go away. Typically, they'll form a committee that will recommend keeping whatever it is that you object to. And they'll say, well, the committee recommended that. All right? And then you'll have a vote, and you schedule a vote. Now, when you have a vote at a school board, it's very important that you get the school board the sense that everybody's in town is upset about this, that it's not just one or two people. And a couple of things to do with this. Number one is if you have something particularly offensive that you've found, something in the reference section of the library or a particular booklet or pamphlet or something that is obvious, that if people look at it, it's bad. There's no explanation needed. Then what you do is you take that and you put a petition on top of it, and you say, I want the attached material out of our school, and you start circulating that petition around town. And you get signatures. And maybe you get 20 signatures, maybe you'll get a 50, maybe you'll get 100. Who knows? Maybe you'll get 1,000. But you get as many as you can. And then when you go and talk to the school board and they say, well, you know, you're just one person, you say, no, I represent these 100 people who signed the petition, or 500 people, or 50 people, however many it is. You're no longer speaking for yourself. Now, the second thing is, if you're going to have a vote of the school board, get your people to call the school board members in the 5 days before the meeting. Place phone calls to the school board members. Now, it's very important that you do this in a way that's not going to get the school board members mad at you because people are making obscene phone calls or whatever. So we tell people, be polite on the phone. All you do is you say, Mr. School Board Member or Miss School Board Member, I want you to vote against this program next Tuesday night. And if they don't want to discuss it any further, you don't have to say another word. If you get their answering machine, because these days they're very good at putting answering machines on, you leave the same message. This is Jane Doe, and I just want to let you know that I'm calling so you'd vote against this program Tuesday night. When we started this, we used to ask school board members, how many phone calls do you need to get before you think there's a major problem? The universal answer was 3. If I get 3 phone calls on an issue, I think I got a major problem. Right? If you can get them 12 phone calls, they'll come into that meeting thinking everybody in town is upset. Okay? If you then have a lot of people at the meeting, that'll just reinforce that. So you get as many people as you can out to the meeting. By the way, people in neighboring towns can't speak at a school board meeting, but they certainly can sit in the audience and clap. There's nothing wrong with that. And you can go over to their meetings and clap for them, too. Okay? Get as many people there as you can. Make them understand that the community is upset about this. Now, they're going to hold a vote, and you're going to lose. Happens almost every time. Right? If there's 9 people on the school board, you might even lose by a vote of 8-1. That's a good vote. You know, 9-0 is the usual kind of thing. Or 7-2, and you're going to lose. And then what do? The answer is you come back to the next school board meeting, and you raise the same problem again. And they say, well, we voted on that in the last meeting. And you say, yes, but you didn't vote correctly, so you obviously don't understand the problem. And you raise the same issue. And you keep raising the same issue. And if you read the Bible, you know God says it's by persistence that you will get many things. And this works well with school boards. They may offer you some little thing to try to pacify you. If it's something nice, take it and then keep fighting. Just don't give up. The third year when you come back is when they start to take you seriously. It's why we like working with Catholics and Mormons. They have so many kids, they're going to be around for a long time in the school system. Okay? If large families are great because what they're counting on is that your child is going to move through the school system, and by the time that you could be effective, you're going to be on to other issues, and they will have outlasted you. So if you have big families, they don't outlast you because you keep having more kids coming up. But don't give up this fight. Just keep this fight going, and you can win. And in the third year to fourth year is when we find that we start to get some real major victories. In Mount Vernon, I will tell you that the school-based clinic is no longer in the Mount Vernon schools. It was thrown out. I will tell you that the sex education program, although there's some vestiges of it still there, all the funding has been taken away from it, and the position of family life education coordinator was done away with. There is no such position. That their plans to expand the program to other grade levels were completely done away with, and all of that was done because the people refused to give up. It took them almost 4 years to win the fight, and the final vote was a very interesting vote. The final vote, they had been stuck at a 4-3 vote in a seven-member school board for a long time. 4 in favor of the program, 3 against the program. And this had been going on, and they had been getting votes rescheduled about every 6 months, and the vote was always the same. And this one night they went in, and it was another rescheduling of the vote, and they expected the same results, and the vote came out, and the vote was 4-3, but this time it was 4 people against the program. One school board member who had been in favor of the program since the very beginning changed his vote. And the people went up to him afterwards and thanked him, said, "Thank you for changing your vote. But why? Why now? What caused you to change your vote?" He said, "Well, you know, I was leaving the house tonight, and I was coming out, and I knew we were going to vote on this sex education battle again." He said, "And it suddenly occurred to me that my daughter had taken this course in the school." He said, "So I went over to my daughter, and I said, 'What did you think of the sex education program in the school?' And she said, 'It was terrible, Dad. They told us to do all the things that you and Mom say we shouldn't do.'" He said, "Well, I'm not going to vote for any program like that," so he voted against it. We said, "Why didn't you ask her 3 years ago? Could have saved us a lot of time." Right? But God wasn't ready yet for you to win that fight. Now, I'll tell you what you won't read in Matthew 10. And if you get this point, then you'll have the point that will allow you to win this fight, and the point that the other side will never understand. In Matthew chapter 10, when you read it, I will tell you what you will not find. And it's very key. Nowhere in Matthew 10 does God say to his apostles, "I want you to go into a town, and I want you to count up how many Christians there are. And then I want you to preach for 6 weeks. And at the end of 6 weeks, I want you to take another count of the Christians. And if you've increased the number of Christians by 40%, you're doing a good job." He does not say that. What he does say is, "You preach my word, I'll take care of the rest." And that's our message. Our message is not to count our victories by the vote of the school board, but to count our victories by how well we're proclaiming God's truth at school board meetings and around town and discussing this issue. That's where we win. That's all he asks us to do. And then he takes care of the rest in his time. And so our job is to go out and proclaim the truth and let God take care of the vote. And if you can understand that and get that as your principle, you will prevail in this fight eventually in his time. Now, sometimes the fights go quick. We have had some in which we've won the first year where they've thrown programs out, but that's not usual. There have been some that have gone on for 20 years and are still fighting. Not that we've been involved in, but some that we've known about. But the key is, you are not asked to win the fights. You're only asked to proclaim the truth. And that's all God asks. Now, very quickly, in Catholic schools, we've been talking public schools. In Catholic schools, you first have to overcome the feeling of Catholics that all a bishop has to say is "don't do it" and the problem is solved. And that if we can explain to the bishop what our concerns are, all our problems will be over with. That's not what happens. We kind of view the Catholic Church as a dictatorship. In today's world, especially in the United States, it's a bureaucracy. And you have to deal with the bureaucracy. It is not the bishop probably has not even read what goes on in the programs. That's his committee that reads that. And we have to get to the committees. And we have to know what the committee is looking forward and to in terms of what they're creating in terms of programs. And we have to try to influence the committee. Find out who's on your committees. If you're dealing in your parish, and you can't get anywhere with your priest, get to the parish council. Because if you can get enough people on the parish council talking to the priest about changing things, guess what? Some things will happen. Because in today's world, it's a bureaucracy that you're dealing with. You have to find who are the influential people and find where this stuff is coming from, and that's where you have to start focusing. If there's a committee, try to get somebody you know on it. Try to join it yourself. If they won't let you on because they know who you are, get somebody else who they don't quite know about and get them on the committee. All right? Get some influence going. Bring up some questions like this article in the Atlantic Monthly. Just, hey, has anybody seen this article at the next committee meeting on sex education for your bishop's committee? Right? And you start to raise some questions. Unfortunately, in most cases, if you have a solid, good parish pastor, he can make changes quickly. But if you do, you probably don't not going to have the problem because he's going to spot this stuff and he's going to protect you. But in other cases, you want to deal with the bureaucracy and understand that there may be people in your bureaucracy who will lie just as well as the people that we deal with in the public schools will lie. I told you about the Catholic Monsignor who supported the Mount Vernon program. I don't want to leave you without finishing that story because we did a lot of work with that Catholic Monsignor over 6 months to try to understand why he supported the program. And we finally found out he had never seen the program. But he had never seen the program not because he had never asked for the program, but because they had printed up a special program just for him. And whenever he asked to see the program, they showed him one, neatly bound, everything looked nice and formal, had nothing offensive in it at all, absolutely nothing. When he said, do you teach about contraception? They said, absolutely not. Do you teach abortion is okay? Absolutely not. And then he read through the program and none of that stuff was in there. It's just a wonderful program. It was not until one of our parents suddenly realized this and brought him the actual program from the school and he read it that he realized what was actually going on in the school. But it was not his fault. He was being lied to that extent. When he finally found out, he resigned from the Family Life Education Committee and fought to help the fight against the program. That same kind of thing may be happening inside your Catholic bureaucracy. There may be people in there that the documents go so high and then there are some cleanse documents that go higher. Right? Spot those things. Try to find out about those things. The people that you're blaming for acknowledging and endorsing a program may not have been looking at the same program you're looking at. And you say, how am I going to find out? Just get in and fight. One of the things we find out in this fight is if you're persistent, God takes care of things. We were in Birmingham, Alabama, and we were doing a radio show. And they were fighting sex education programs. This happened to be in a public school again, but they were fighting sex education programs. And they were having a tough time finding out what was going on inside the schools and getting a copy of particular curriculum. And we mentioned this on the air, on the radio show. We also mentioned on the radio show that we'd be picketing outside of Planned Parenthood Abortuary the next day. And as we were picketing outside the Planned Parenthood Abortuary, this car drove up, and this guy gets out and says, who was on the radio yesterday talking about the sex education program in the school? And I was there, and the local guy said, yeah, it was me. He said, I got something for you. And he opened up his trunk, and he took out a box. And it was the entire curriculum and all of the correspondence and all kinds of internal details of what was going on in the schools. He says, here, it's yours. Right? And they were then able to, they had all the information they needed then. Right? But God will provide if you're persistent, if you're out there fighting and doing and making things known and letting know what you're going to do, he will provide for you. He'll let you know what's going on in your bureaucracy if you keep plugging away at it. If you say, oh, that's too difficult, and you go home and you sit down, you're not going to find out anything. You got to keep looking. You got to keep plugging away. Right? Because there's one final thing that I'll point to you, and then we'll have about 5 or 10 minutes for some quick questions. There's one final thing in Matthew chapter 10. In Matthew 10, Christ tells you, first of all, this is not going to be easy. He says there's going to be a lot of anguish, there's going to be a lot of fighting, there's going to be a lot of problems. He says they're going to call you a lot of names. He said, they call me Beelzebub. What do you think they're going to call you? But he says, whoever proclaims me before man, I will proclaim him before my Father. And whoever denies me before man, I will deny him before my Father. And so he's given us probably the greatest personal reason to want to go out and to preach his word, because he says, if you go out and you speak out for me, then when it's time for you to face your judgment, I'll put in a good word for you. You can't have somebody much better putting in a good word for you. But in addition to that, let me just tell you that the folks who wrote this document are going to be surprised someday, because if you understand this document, they say there may or may not be a God, and they say there is no heaven and there is no hell. This is all out of Humanist Manifesto, too. And they're going to be surprised, because they're going to die, because we all die. And they're going to face God, and you notice heaven and hell that they don't think is there. They may wind up spending eternity where they don't want to be. That's up to God. But our job as parents, as grandparents, is to make sure that our kids aren't one of those who get surprised. That we don't abandon our kids to this kind of philosophy that's being taught in the sex education programs. And, very important, God says, love your neighbor as yourself. We can't only worry about our kids, we got to worry about our neighbor's kids too. So even if we don't have children in the school, even if we're single, even if we have our kids elsewhere or homeschooling, we still have to worry about what's going on in our school, because our neighbor's kids are being exposed there. And if we can protect our kids, then we've done what God's asked. Thank you. Yes.
Yes, I'm Gina Cote from Canada, New Brunswick, Canada. And I came here this weekend looking for answers because of the situation that's in Canada at this time. One particular area, one French school. I started Parents for Chastity, and some of the parents are looking to me for an answer. So I wasn't going to come this weekend. I happened to look into our apostolate funds. There was enough to take an aircraft, so I'm here. The answer that I was looking for was how to stop this program. I did make a statement, a few statements, the first night I arrived here, and some people in this audience would know what we have. But just to be brief, we have a curriculum that lasts for 80 minutes every day. And it's for grade 9, 14 years old. It's so horrible that 4 children experimented and lost their virginity since September. Also, 2 children did not want to be taught the curriculum, and their parents said it was good for them. But your answers were good, and I see what you're saying, because you're attacking or fighting or encountering teachers and principals. What we have in Canada, we have young people. There's only 3 that's about my age that have taken their children out and homeschool them. That's over 50. But the children's parents are 30 and under, or maybe even 35. They've been indoctrinated in already sex or Planned Parenthood sex programs. And their philosophy is quite different from ours, as you know. They can't tap into that spiritual realm. So what we have is parents who want the curriculum, not the teachers. In fact, the teachers are almost reluctant to teach it. They have to really scout around the school and find one. And then the teacher says, I love kids too much. I don't approve of the program, but I love kids too much, so I'm going to save them so they can be converted. That's the philosophy.
Okay.
Save them by using the condom.
Okay.
Okay. So how I was looking for this weekend how we can stop that program immediately, because it's horrible. And how I can get to the parents with that type of mentality. Now, just a little bit more here. They will not attend meetings. We try that. We tried that all last week and the week before. And they, you know, one will show up. They're not interested. They're totally trusting of the school system. That's another thing we found.
Now, do you have school boards like we talk about in terms of...
I made a presentation to the school board.
Okay.
But I can't make a presentation to that particular school board because it's straight out of my own district. Will not listen to that.
Okay. Well, you have to find one or two parents in that district. Now, you said your kids go to it, so it's got to be...
Kids are grown up.
Okay.
Just another little thing here.
Okay.
We're a program we have that we do talks. It's called Family Messengers.
Right.
And what I do, I speak from a perspective of a parent
right.
who raised her children in chastity. I have five children, and I've raised them, and they embrace the chastity message. Now, the young girl speaks from a perspective of a daughter who responded also. And that is successful, but it involves the consecration. We
right.
go into the Fatima message, and it I think that's the whole thing, because the chastity message only lasts about a year, the research shows. We
right.
need to get into the spiritual.
Okay.
Okay.
What I would recommend, number one, you need one or two parents in that district. If you don't have one or two parents in that district who will fight, there's no way you can fight it being outside the district. So we have some districts that we can't get a couple of parents, but in most cases we can find one or two parents. Once we find the parents, they've got to go bring the issue to the school board. Every meeting of the school board, never letting them off the hook, continually bringing the issue up. They've got the fact that the parents in the town won't attend meetings will work to your advantage, because you should be able to get some people out on your side to the meetings, and if they're not going to come out on their side, it'll work to your advantage. Circulate petitions amongst people in town. Find something particularly offensive in this program and get the petitions circulated. What you've got to convince the school board is that there are more parents who don't want this program than parents who do want this program. If you can convince them of that, whether or not it's true, if you can convince them of that, then you have a chance of winning. What we've had to do in Mount Vernon before we actually won the whole fight is the parents took to picketing the school. One day a week for 2 hours, there was a picket every week of that school. Right? It was by three people, I will tell you. Two of them were grandmothers in their 70s, and one was a woman who had a child in the school. They would picket the school. It's caused such a lot of commotion and attention to it that it brought the issue to a head, and it's one of the things that finally brought it as a catalyst. But what you've got to do, but if you don't have parents in the school district, at least one or two, there's no way that you're going to be able to get it out. You have to have one or two parents who live in the school district, not necessarily have students at the school, but who live in the school district and therefore have a right to speak out. But just be very, very persistent on it.
Thank you.
Yes.
What is the linchpin that you would go after in states where sex education is mandated? Where do you begin
okay.
there?
In states where sex education is mandated, the first thing I would do is to read exactly what is mandated. In most cases, it is not what the local school people are telling you. It is something, in most cases, it is a very general mandate. Now, there's a couple of exceptions to this, but it's a very general mandate. You know, sex education must be taught, and it must include the following topics. Is about as detailed as most of the state-level programs do. That's why Planned Parenthood and Seekers are very upset with most of these, even the ones that are mandated. So first, understand what is mandated. Second of all, you then have a two-pronged battle. As far as your schools are concerned, you have to get the least offensive program you can get in under whatever the existing mandates are, okay? Because they have to teach something. But at the same time, you have to be working with the legislature to do away with the mandates, all right? And that gets into the whole issue of dealing with elected officials and getting their vote changed and convincing them that they should do away with this mandate at the state level. Anything that they passed, they can unpass. They can now come back and say, no, we don't want that anymore. So that's where it has to be a two-pronged battle. If you do just the first without doing the second, if you just try to get the minimum offensive program in without fighting to get the mandate changed, then you're not really going to have any serious effect on it.
I have a question. I actually went through a pretty horrible program about, I guess, seventh grade. It would have been about 8 years ago. But we live in the school district now that I grew up in, and I was wondering, you know, the teacher who taught the program is still there, and it's very awkward for me. I thought about going up there and talking to them about it, but, you know, I mean, that whole...
Well,
I'm wondering how I can use that to my advantage.
Well, I would, when they, when what I would do is I would not be afraid to go up and use it. I would attack the program, not necessarily the teacher, okay, unless you have some specific evidence that this teacher is bringing in things that are not part of the approved program. But if it's an approved program that she's teaching, I would attack the program, not the individual. And I would, if you have cases of friends of yours who have taken the program and have had bad effects from the program, those things are very, very useful in helping to fight the program. If you don't have those cases, then just go in as if you hadn't ever lived in a school district before and just fight it that way.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
My name is Glenn Washington. I live in Gainesville, Georgia, and I want to thank you for your comments today and let you know that my personal experience, every single thing you said over the last hour and a half is absolutely correct. I'm in the Archdiocese of Atlanta. This is, for some of you may not be aware, this is kind of like the mission fields of the Catholic Church. There really aren't a whole lot of Catholics down there, and so we live in a pretty Protestant part of the country. I'm on the sex education committee for the parental sex education committee for my county. In the state of Georgia, the legislature required the state school board required that in every school district you have to have a sex educational materials review committee that reviews the materials that are to be taught in the school, and that committee must be a primarily parental committee. And in our instance, the primary translated into a majority of one on the committee. But it's been a very interesting process, and what we experienced over the last 12 months, this has been in existence for 1 year, we're in our second year now, is exactly what you described over the last, as I said, the last hour and a half. We have been very successful. We do not have in our county any teaching of artificial contraception. We did until the last month. And one of the things that we did, a couple of things that we did that I think helped us be successful, was we always talked about artificial contraception. Now, this is kind of a new phrase to many people. And we constantly hammered home this idea that it's artificial. This is artificial contraception. It kind of makes people think a little bit. We also, for 12 months, talked about what we refer to as the three myths of artificial contraception, teaching artificial contraception. Number one was the myth that it was safe for kids to teach them to use artificial contraception. And we explained why it was not safe. And we gave them lots of statistics and facts and figures. Number two was the myth that you could teach artificial contraception and not give mixed messages to kids. Now, Planned Parenthood, the Planned Parenthood Federation and the Guttmacher Institute actually have marvelous statistics that show and demonstrate when you teach artificial contraception what that does to the sexual activity among kids. Use their own statistics against them. And then the third myth is the idea that when you that teaching artificial contraception is something that is universally acceptable to parents. Now, we don't, in the Roman Catholic faith, believe in artificial contraception. That's not something that is shared by our Protestant brethren. However, most people can understand the idea that you are violating my beliefs, just as you said. And most people accept that.